I'd like to just begin by finishing up the proof of that theorem, the integrability of the modified kernel. And it boiled down to looking at an alternating sum b of x, first of all a sum, so this is defined for pairs of parabolic subgroups p1 and p2, and it was a sum over mu in MP1 of Q, and then a sum over a third parabolic subgroup embedded between the two of them, and then you have the sign, which is a critical ingredient, and then we wrote it in terms of the Lie algebra on a unipotent radical. We noted that that could be written as a sum over elements zeta in NP1 PQ. This is a Lie algebra of the unipotent group capital N P1 PQ, and then an integral over the Lie algebra NPA of f of x to the minus 1. So x is the variable we're trying to integrate over eventually, and we have the exponential of a sum. X, dx, d capital X. So you've got these two variables inside the exponential, this being a lattice in an adelic vector space and script n p1 p of a, and we noted that it looked like it was going to work out if we applied the Poisson summation formula. I wrote it down last time, I won't write it down again, but applying Poisson summation, to the sum over, well, the sum here, the sum over zeta. And so what we're doing is we're, all of these other things, just for the purpose of this little exercise, this variable, are to be fixed, and we're to regard this expression as a function in the lattice, lattice here in the adelic vector space, or more generally, a function of an adelic variable in NP1P of A. And so we just take the Poisson summation formula on that. In other words, we take the Fourier transform of this variable, just in the abelian sense. It's a little more general than classical Fourier transforms because we're taking an adelic Fourier transform, but nonetheless, we take the Fourier transform in this variable, and then we sum the result over the lattice of characters that is dual to this lattice. So what does that give us? It gives us that b of x is the sum over mu, I won't rewrite the variables, the sum over p between p1 and p2, minus 1 to the dimension of AP mod AG. Okay, so then we have a sum over, if the adels are such that you can identify the dual, that is to say the lattice of the additive group of irreducible characters of the adels, you can identify it with itself if you fix an additive character on the group of adels. And so the dual lattice to this could be taken to be the same set, NP1P of Q. And again, I have to integrate this over a variable x upper 1, say, in NP1P of A. So there's a variable in this thing. And then we have a variable of integration x here. So I'll just put the two of them together, and I'll integrate over NP1 of A. So NP1 of A of f of x to the minus 1 mu times the exponential, let's call it x1, x to the minus 1. But then we have to average that against a character on the subgroup NP1PA of this whole thing, the character given by C. And so that is C. So I'll write this down formally in a minute. This is supposed to be an additive character. And then I take the dot product of this with x1 dx1. Okay, where psi is a non-trivial additive character on the Abel, which is invariant mod Q, and this I mean simply to be the dot product relative to any fixed identification of this vector space or adelic module, free adelic module, any identification of it with a direct sum of adels, which we would do by choosing a set of root vectors in this thing. So in other words, I can identify this with several copies of the adels, and then I can just take the dot product of this with itself and then evaluate that on some fixed additive character on the adels. Pardon me? That's right. That's right. So I'm thinking of NP1P of Q. That's contained in NP1 of Q. So this represents, this represents a subgroup of the group of all lattice of characters on NP1. And I'm just taking, I could take this dot product up there for any thing in NP1Q, never mind the upper P, never mind the subgroup given by upper P, but I'm just taking it over the subgroup. Oh, I meant that X upper one. I'm calling. That's right. That's right. That's right. And so if I take a basis of root vectors, that will be the case. A basis of root vectors would then give a basis. Its intersection with this thing would be a basis of this thing. And so the dot product of something in here with an arbitrary thing identifies it with its dual. Of psi? Sorry? I don't think so. As long as psi is invariant under Q, as long as it's a character that's invariant under Q. So this, if we think about that for a minute, if the each, so we're letting p vary, and for every p, we have a sum over a lattice of characters that is a submodule of this module here. But otherwise, there's no dependence whatsoever on p in that integral. The only dependence on p, apart from the sign, is that we're summing over a different subset of the characters that are contained in this largest group of, largest lattice of characters. So every p, there's a subgroup. And if p is very small, it's a much smaller subgroup. And if you think about it for a minute, any character in here is going to belong to, it might belong to several of these things, but if you think about it for a minute, any character in here will belong to a smallest one of these. In other words, there is actually not just a minimal, but actually a smallest p, such that a given character, a given element in here, will belong to this subgroup corresponding to p. And then it'll belong to all subgroups for every p which contains that minimal one. Well, that means that our exclusion, you called it the exclusion-inclusion principle, the one that the sum over all elements, all subsets, of the alternating sum over all subsets of a finite set is zero unless that finite set is empty. So, if psi belongs to any proper, so if you pick a character here, and then if it happens to belong to any proper one of these, then it'll appear several times up there, and they will cancel because there is a minus sign. So, since this is so, we can therefore, finally, and this is the final promise of being able to actually affect the cancellation implicit in that alternating sum over p in the minus sign. So we can finally get the cancellation from the alternating sum over p. And so what, let's do the following. Let me take, let me write NP1, P2, Q. So this is the, in fact, each of these is contained in NP1, P2 of Q. P is smaller than P2. So let me take this to be, this is the universal group, additive group of characters that contains all of these. Let me write prime for the subgroup, or the subset, not a, it's not a group, the set of C in NP1, P2 of Q, such that C does not lie in any of the smaller ones. Anything that does not belong to that prime in here will occur several times corresponding to different proper p. This would be p not equal to p2, proper p. So just by the inclusion-exclusion principle, so you might, I'll say check this, but if you think about it, it's just the inclusion-exclusion principle. That B of X, that you can ignore any of the elements that do not lie in this subset. And so that B of X equals, as a, there'll actually be a sign in front because it would be the sign of a P2G. AG. I mean, to put it another way, the only contribution to this will be the contribution when P is equal to P2, and where C ranges over this subset of NP1, P2 of Q. And so the sign for that is this, but the sign now no longer has any importance. We've done the cancellation. So it's a sum over mu in MP1 of Q. The sum over C in NP1, P2, Q prime, and then the integral over NP1A of F of x to the minus 1, mu exponential of x1, little x to the minus 1, C of little c x1, dx1. Now, what does that gain us? How does that help us? I'm going to try to explain in a couple of words, but let me just say that it's really an exercise at this point to show that the thing. If you remember where we had gotten to, where we're trying to show that this thing is integrable in x in P1Q GA1. And we looked at different coordinates of x, and the remember that the one we really had a product of this with another function a of x, and that had the effect of making all of the coordinates in x compactly supported, except for the part of x, the coordinate of x, h12, that lay in the vector space ap1, p2. And we have to be kind of careful with that. So the things we originally wrote down really do diverge. They're not integrable in h1, h2, taken as individual terms. But now that we've done this cancellation, I'm claiming that this thing is going to be rapidly decreasing in h1, 2. Now, why is that? So just think of a little h1, 2 here, or rather its exponential sitting in here. And it's in there's a conjugation by h, say, exponential of h1 2 up to the minus 1. That's what the coordinate of this vector would give you. And you're going to conjugate a vector x1 in the Lie algebra of a unipotent radical. Well, what does h1 2 do to such a vector? Think of this as an upper triangular matrix. And think of this as a diagonal matrix, which is in the positive chamber. So what does conjugation of a diagonal matrix, that's what H12 is, remember, because we had tau P1 of H12 was positive. So it's something in the positive chamber. So if it were in the positive chamber, it would conjugate x1 by expanding it. But unfortunately, it's not this that we're conjugating, it's the inverse. So if you take the inverse of a diagonal matrix, say an SL2 whose first component is much smaller than the second component, and you conjugate a diagonal matrix with an upper triangular unipotent matrix with that, what does it do to it? It contracts it. So that would be very bad, because that would continue to conjugating this with it, it would continue to make this near zero, and you wouldn't get any benefit from the fact that F is compactly supported. But that's why we've done the Fourier transform. If you conjugate this thing by the inverse of this, you can make a change of variables and conjugate this thing, not by the inverse, but by this. Oh, excuse me. Sorry. And I seem to have it up there, too. Hey, I'm okay there, but I seem to start to write. So because of this x, then the h12, I'm just arguing kind of heuristically here, but the h12 coordinate conjugates this thing by the inverse of a positive, something in the positive chamber. But when you change variables, you then take the inverse of this, and you're ending up conjugating this thing by this. Well, it's the dot product, so that's the same thing as conjugating this thing by that. And what that does is to expand a unipotent matrix. Now, there are many coordinates in H1, many sort of individual coordinates in this thing, and I would like this vector to, by under conjugation by this, to expand in each of these coordinates. And that's exactly what this set buys for you. It, if you think about it, every element in here has a non-zero component in some root vector that gives that is non-zero for one of the components of this thing. And so this expands this thing, and because F is compactly supported, its Fourier transform is rapidly decreasing in this variable, and therefore, rapidly decreasing in this variable. So if I expand this variable by something here, I'm going to get something that is in fact rapidly decreasing at that, and will be integrable. And the fact that it's rapidly decreasing will cancel this polynomial that we had from the norm of the other variable, H2. So I don't know if those words help, but I claim that it really is just an exercise to show that for any C in N P1 P2 Q prime, the expression in the brackets, let's say this thing, this expression in the brackets, is rapidly decreasing in H12, which, remember, was the A P1 P2 component of X. And hence, that now, there are going to be infinitely many C here to take care of. This is certainly an infinite set, but it's like summing over a lattice, each of whose elements is expanded by a given variable. Summing a rapidly decreasing function over all points in a lattice or some subset of a lattice, which is being expanded by a variable. So if the function's rapidly decreasing, you can sum over those lattice points. And if you take a subset on which whose elements is rapidly increasing, is being expanded by this variable, the sum itself will be rapidly decreasing. And so, and hence that G, the integral over GQ mod GA1 of KT of X dx, by virtue of the fact that we've already shown, by virtue of the fact that it's bounded by the sum over pairs P1 and P2, as the integral of P1Q over GA1 of A of X, B of X, dx, it is finite. So if this seems, I mean, I claim it really is, once you just figure out, sort out what these root vectors are going to look like, what the elements in here are going to look like, it's perfectly doable. But you could try it for G equals SL2. It's quite very clear in that case. So it's an easy exercise. and for general G, I think it probably would be doable if you had some experience with, say, algebraic groups and root vectors, but it's in the this Duke Journal paper, 45, 1978, and its theorem, it's the latter part, well, that the of theorem 7.1. Theorem 7.1, in fact, is the proof of the convergence of that integral. So that theorem, the techniques in that theorem, can be reused several times to do more things, which I would like to describe. There's a variant of that theorem. I mean, as it stands, you might say that right, what's k of x? Kt of x. It's the sum over p. It's the alternating sum over p. Sum over delta GQ of what we have. We have the kernel KP delta X tau P hat HP delta X minus T. And remember what this thing is. It's gotten from the function f. By integrating over the unipotent radical and summing over elements mu in the group M P. Now, what we want to do, if we're thinking of the case of compact quotient, we now know we can integrate this thing, but what does that mean to actually compute it on the right-hand side? I mean, if we're thinking of compact quotient, we would like to be able to express the integral of this thing maybe as a bunch of integrals over conjugacy classes in GQ. So, can you break up the integral? As a sum of integrals over conjugacy classes in GQ. The answer is not quite, actually. There's an interesting thing that happens that is always the bane of studying things like this. You can go a long way towards doing that, but at least at first try, you can't quite break it up into a sum of contributions over conjugacy classes. What's the problem? The problem is unipotent conjugacy classes. They are always really troublesome thing sometimes. You might say, where do they come in compact quotient case that we already know about? The answer is they don't come in at all. One of the theorems, I guess it must be, maybe it's in the Burrell-Harris-Chandra paper, if GQ mod GA is compact, then every element in GQ is semi-simple. So they don't come in. But they certainly do come in for a more general group. And to describe what you can get, at least at first try, by attempting to break this thing up into contributions from conjugacy classes, let's describe as a variant of Theorem 1. What is appropriate for doing this is to define an equivalence relation that's a little bit weaker than simply conjugacy in GQ. So to describe it, let me remind you that any element gamma in GQ has a Jordan decomposition. This is a unique decomposition. Gamma, a product of a mu and a nu, where mu, I could also write that as gamma semisimple, is an element in GQ that is semisimple. So by semisimple, I mean that if you take a finite dimensional, G's a general group, if you take a finite dimensional representation of that group, then to be semisimple means that over the complex points in the GLN in which you've embedded G, that you can diagonalize gamma. To be semisimple. And nu, we could write that as gamma u, that's an element in GQ, which actually, remember we're writing lower mu to be the centralizer of mu in GQ, so you can choose the unipotent part to commute with mu. In fact, you have to if you want the decomposition to be unique, and this is unipotent. So that means that if you take a finite dimensional representation of G, and you look, therefore, identify nu as an element in some general linear group, that it's unipotent, that namely the identity matrix minus nu has some power of it is zero. And so this is unique, and this is the Jordan decomposition. So the Jordan decomposition, of course, in GLN is given by Jordan normal form. The diagonal, that's of course over the complex numbers, but I'm just stating it in its sort of basic form. You take your rational matrix and look at it in the complex group, and then the diagonal component in its Jordan, the diagonal part of its Jordan normal form is the semisimple part of gamma, and the block, the Jordan blocks with ones on the diagonal and ones on some of the super diagonals, that's the unipotent part. But the Jordan normal form is going to have lambdas. You mean for GL, for describing GLN? Or for here I've made them commute. I've made them commute here because this is the centralizer. This is the centralizer of mu in a GQ. So I've made them commute by doing that. All right. So the equivalence relation that I want to put on GQ is, it's weaker than conjugacy. Let's say that two elements, gamma 1 and gamma 2 in GQ are equivalent if they're semi-simple parts. Those are two semi-simple elements in GQ. We'll ask that the semi-simple parts be conjugate. So let's write gamma equivalent to gamma prime if gamma S is GQ conjugate to gamma prime S. And then let's write, why don't we write O for the set of equivalence classes in GQ. So the equivalence classes, you could think of them as being bijective with the set of semi-simple conjugacy classes in GQ. Any one of these equivalence classes contains exactly one semi-simple class, but it also contains all other elements in GQ that you can get by multiplying things in this semi-simple, in representative of the semi-simple class with unipotent elements that commute with it. So you kind of thicken the semi-simple class by adding all possible unipotent elements that commute with a representative of that semi-simple class. So, for example, there are plenty of conjugacy classes, interesting conjugacy classes in GQ that, whose centralizer, semi-simple conjugacy classes, whose centralizer is contains no unipotent elements. And so there, this equivalence relation would be the same as conjugacy. On the other hand, the most extreme case in the other direction is where the semi-simple class in a given element in here is the identity. And then that equivalence class consists simply of all unipotent elements in GQ. So we're basically taking an equivalence relation that kind of dodges the issue of what we do with unipotent elements. So any O in capital O, this is weaker than conjugacy, so any one of these things is a union of conjugacy classes in GQ, exactly one of which is semi-simple. So this is, what happens for GLN? This is pretty easy to imagine for GLN. So the Jordan decomposition is given by Jordan normal form, and gamma would be equivalent to gamma prime in GLNQ if and only if the semi-simple parts of gamma and gamma prime are conjugate. In other words, if and only if gamma and gamma prime have the same, with including repeating together with the same multiplicities, the same complex eigenvalues. Or in other words, that they have the same characteristic polynomials. So in other words, in the case of GLN, the set of equivalence classes is in bijection with the set of characteristic polynomials. They have to be characteristic polynomials of invertible matrices, and they'd have to be characteristic polynomials of rational matrices. So I guess characteristic polynomials whose constant term is non-zero and whose coefficients are are rationals. So it's a natural kind of thing, bijective with characteristic polynomials. What is interesting from the question we're going to look at about in the trace formula, the contribution of one of these classes to the trace formula, what is particularly simple for one of these conjugacy classes would be the case that O doesn't intersect any proper parabolic subgroup. So if you've got a class O in GLN with the property that its intersection with every proper parabolic subgroup, standard parabolic subgroup, is empty, the intersection of O with P is empty for every proper parabolic subgroup, that's the same thing as saying that the characteristic polynomial of little o. So we've identified O with elements in O with characteristic polynomials, and so this condition of not intersecting any parabolic subgroup would be saying that the characteristic polynomial of O is irreducible over Q. These are the these would be the simplest classes. These would be the ones which whose contribution to the trace formula, if it doesn't intersect any proper parabolic subgroup, none of the correction terms somehow would have any contribution from the given O. And it's things like this that ought to contribute exact to the trace formula for non-compact quotient, exactly the same thing which occurred in the case of compact quotient. In other words, these are the classes in the given group which are like the set of all classes in the case when you have compact quotient. But of course there are many others. A more general condition than this, but one which is still a special case, namely the case that you have an element here that has no unipotent L, that all of whose elements are semi-simple. O contains only one conjugacy class. That's going to be the same thing as the elements in O are all semi-simple. And that's going to be the same thing as saying that the characteristic polynomial of O is not irreducible, but that its irreducible components over Q are all distinct. These are either, depending on how much you've sort of thought about these things, these are all pretty self-evident, or they follow in an elementary way from basic properties of linear algebra. So the characteristic polynomial of O has a distinct, has no repeated irreducible factors. Over Q. If it had some repeated irreducible factors, then you could find a unipotent element, slip a unipotent element between those two repeated irreducible factors that commuted with the semi-simple element. All right. So let's. Why don't we just break up? We've got our kernel, K of X and X. So in general, let's write our kernel K of X and X as, so it's the sum over gamma in GQ, F of X to the minus 1 gamma X. So let's break that as break the sum over GQ into the sum over these equivalence classes that are a little bit larger than just conjugacy classes. Sum over gamma in O of f of x to the minus 1 gamma x. So let's call this k O of x and x. Okay, so we can break our kernel up clearly into pieces corresponding to these equivalence classes. And we can do the same thing with the induced kernels, the KPs. So let's write KP O, KP of X and X as the sum over gamma, so this is the sum over gamma, so just recalling, this is the sum over gamma in MPQ, the integral over NPA of f of x to the minus 1 gamma n x dn, And we could write that, let's write that as a sum over all of these equivalence classes of KPO of X and X, where KPO of X and X is simply the sum over elements gamma in the intersection of MPQ with O, and then the integral over NPA of f of x to the minus 1 gamma n x dn. Okay, so then with this, we've broken up the kernel and each of the induced kernels into a sum of components over these equivalence classes. So we can therefore write the truncated kernel, K, we can write K T of X as a sum over all equivalence classes, K T O of X, where K T O of X depends on the function f, and then is just exactly given by the same formula as kt of x, except you replace the kernels kp by the kernels kpo. In other words, it's the sum over p minus 1 times the dimension of ap mod ag, sum over delta in pq mod gq of KPO of delta X, and then tau P hat of HP delta X minus T. So this is just by definition. We can break this up into a sum of contributions from these equivalence classes. Now, we could have done this with conjugacy classes. We wouldn't have had to. We could certainly get a formula like that with just conjugacy classes rather than these more general equivalence classes. But where this is necessary is, I would like, I mean, what we're really interested in is the integral of K of this truncated kernel. And I would like to know that the integral of the truncated kernel is the same as the sum of the integrals of these contributions to it from the various equivalence classes. And in order to be able to do that, I would want to know that each of these is integrable, or really what I would want to know is the following. So this is the variant of theorem 1, let's call it theorem 1 prime, that the integral over GQ mod GA1, the sum over O of the absolute values of the KTO of X's, that this is finite. That the this thing is integrable as a double sum. Then that proves that each of the KTOs is integrable, and in fact, that the integral of KT is the sum of the integrals of the KTOs. So, if I tried to give an idea of the proof of Theorem 1, if somehow you were able to follow part of that, the proof of this is exactly the same. It's step by step exactly the same. So this is exactly the same as Theorem 1. You just repeat all of the steps, but there's one critical point that you that you have to use that really relies on the fact that you're using this little, this more general equivalence relation rather than just conjugacy. And that is, if you remember, I think we were doing it last time, we need only use the fact that. So at one point in the proof of theorem one, we had a sum. Well, it was actually in the sum of, it was in this sum here. And where this appeared in the function that we were calling b of x. And we showed that when it occurred in the sum over b of x, with these other characteristic functions in front of it, that you could actually take this over the intersection of MP, I won't mess up that board, but the intersection of MP with P1. So it was where you had a P1 and a P. At one point, we argued that you could take the smaller sum, not over all of NPQ, but rather the intersection of NPQ with P1 of Q. Well, you go through the same steps with each of these, and you'll get the same argument. But what you need to do to make it work from then on is that you need a nice expression for the intersection of P1 with NPQ. Well, we noted before that there is a nice expression for this. It's just, this is just a parabolic subgroup of this. And so it's, we noted that this was MP1 of Q times NP1 upper P of Q. But now, when we're doing this, you have the intersection of this with O, with one of these equivalence classes. And the fact that makes it all work exactly as the proof of theorem one is that this also has a nice expression, that this is the same as MP1Q intersection O. And then the second thing is, in fact, the entire unipotent radical NP1PQ. And that is because, so this would be for any O in O. So it's you could try doing it. It's not difficult, but it's in this little fact is follows from a lemma in this in the Duke Journal. If you write at the beginning, lemma 2-1. But you're going to need this. If you're going to be able to apply the proof that we used for theorem 1, we need this. We had to apply Poisson summation. Remember, we applied Poisson summation formula to this thing to get some terms that were rapidly decreasing. Now, why would this be true? It's because O consists not just of a semi-simple conjugacy class, but every element that you can get by taking elements in the semi-simple conjugacy class and then tacking onto them unipotent elements that commute with it. So because you're thickening the class with as many unipotent elements as you can, it's for that reason that the intersection of this with this includes the whole unipotent radical there. And you really do need that to make the proof work. So just as an aside, the trace formula in Jacquet-Langlands, chapter 16 of Jacquet-Langlands, which was probably the first place that had been written down for any group, it's for GL2, they don't do this. They use something more precise, more complicated, really, but what they do break it up into conjugacy classes, into unipotent conjugacy classes. And nobody has been able to, I don't know that they're, you can, for the applications of the trace formula, you seem not, this seems to be good enough to be able to do this, but it still leaves the question, what would be the contributions to this thing, or to the whole kernel, to K, where have I written it down? Somewhere. What would be the contributions to the kernel K If instead of taking summing over all elements in these equivalence classes, you summed over simply conjugacy classes, it would get very complicated. Nobody's ever been able to make much of the integrals and even prove that they converge, sort of individually. But it's an open problem. There must be something going on there, but it's not understood. Yeah, they do that. They do that. They don't use a proof. Their proof is, they sketch the proof for GL2, and the proof is more, it's really more computational than this general argument, but they do break up, they do give a contribution to all conjugacy classes. Mm-hmm. In that case, the integrals converge, and you can actually write down what they are. Now, I will not have time. I mean, you can deal with the unipotent classes individually in general, but there are some undetermined constants that come out in front of it. We won't have a chance to discuss it, unfortunately. There are some undetermined constants that occur, which have been calculated, which were calculated in Jacquet-Langlands and involved actually Euler's constant for the worst of them. But in the applications of the trace formula, you don't need to know what those constants are, which is lucky. But it still would be, I think, interesting to know what's happening. All right. So what we would just simply do then is to define. We would define JT. Do the obvious thing. We would define JT O of F to be the integral over GQ GA mod GA1 mod GQ of KT O X and F DX. And I didn't say so explicitly last time, but I think I said before that, of course, we would also define JT of F to be the integral of a whole truncated kernel for any O, and therefore what this theorem then tells you is that JT of F is a sum of contributions from each of these equivalence classes. Now I'm going to so the next step, there's two things which I'm going to try to do rather quickly next time. I would like to be able to have some time. I have two lectures left. I'd like to be able to have some time to say at least something about what happens when you deal with the spectral side. But there's still two remaining questions on this. First of all, the question of how this behaves as a function of t. I mentioned that you show that, in fact, it's actually a polynomial in t. And then the second question is to look at any given one of these things. I mean, this still isn't very explicit. It is just something involving some truncated sums over, among other things, the elements in one of these equivalence classes. But one would actually like to evaluate that explicitly as some sort of explicit integral over the conjugacy classes in here. So I'll say pretty quickly actually next time about these two questions and try to reserve Friday for saying in really general terms what happens on the spectral side.